The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think there had been a lot of healthy skepticism about Boris Johnson's election campaign pledge to get Brexit done, given that there was the recognition that in many ways the much tougher fights now had to happen. So in terms of negotiating the divorce, it was fairly clear what the provisions were that needed to be agreed. And with the exception of the handling of the Irish border, a lot of those were relatively clear. But now we are moving on to the much more difficult and the much more contentious fights. And what you are already seeing is the EU arguing that it wants to maintain level playing field commitments, that it wants the UK to agree to continue aligning on a certain number of regulations to end up easing trade between the two sides. And yet at the same time, you have Boris Johnson taking a much tougher stance, suggesting that that's not going to be the case. And so even though there is some clarity, there is some relief, we are going to be able to finalize the divorce within the next couple of weeks, I think there is an expectation that 2020 is going to be quite contentious between the two sides while they try and hammer out arrangements on what this actually looks like.
I'm Gordon All, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 21st, 2019. This week, following a resounding victory by Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party in British elections, members of Parliament have backed Johnson's plan to withdraw from the EU by January 31st. But before they did that, Benjamin Wittes got on the phone from an undisclosed location with Brookings Senior Fellow and Brexit expert Amanda Sloat, who is here in the Jungle Studio to discuss Britain's recent election, what it means for Brexit, and what it might portend for the future of the United Kingdom. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Amanda Sloat on Boris Johnson and Brexit.
Amanda, when we last spoke about this, we had a great deal of uncertainty as to where things were heading on just about all fronts. And one of the eventualities that we did not discuss was we talked about whether the Conservative Party was imploding. We talked about, you know, uncertainty for Brexit going forward. One thing we did not discuss is the possibility of a sweeping historic victory for Boris Johnson that would leave all of his non-conservative party competition in the dust. How did we get from, you know, Boris Johnson can't govern to here?
So when we talked and looking at the opinion polls going into the election, they were consistently showing the Conservatives up around 10, 11 points, even higher at previous moments, even though there had been some misleading polls going into the 2015 and the 2017 elections. You are right that this was a sizable win for the Conservative Party, but I would say a couple of things to put that into context. They won around 365 out of 650 seats, which gives them a solid governing majority and 44% of the vote share, which is the highest that they got since Margaret Thatcher became prime minister in 1979. But if you look at that in context, when Tony Blair was Labour prime minister, he actually got an even higher percentage of that in elections in 97, 2001, and 2005. So this was certainly a sizable win for the Conservative Party, but not among the largest that we have seen in recent years. And rather than necessarily seeing this as much as a conservative win, I think the big story of the election was the complete implosion of support for the Labour Party. It only won 203 seats, which was the party's worst result in 84 years. And what was particularly significant was that seats held by the Labour Party since the Second World War, including seats held by former Labour Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, flipped to the Conservative Party.
All right. And there are basically two competing or maybe competing and overlapping accounts, maybe three, of the Labour Party implosion. One is the sort of person, the toxic person of Jeremy Corbyn. One is, relatedly, the hard left stance that the Labour Party took. And the third is the sort of party's confusion about its Brexit stand and its sort of inability to present a popular, clear alternative. In roughly what percentage explanatory power do you give each of these three factors?
Those absolutely are the three factors, and the willingness to adhere to different ones depends on who you ask. Certainly, Jeremy Corbyn, the official Labour line, seems to be that people were supportive of Brexit, and this is why they voted for the Conservatives. Tony Blair was out today blaming the essentially socialist policies of the Labour Party, the hostility towards Western foreign policy, the anti-Semitism that Corbyn was not handling well within the party. But there was an interesting opinion poll that came out in the last couple of days looking at the main reasons why voters did not vote for Labour. The three explanations that you cite were the three that were given. The overwhelming majority show the unpopularity of Jeremy Corbyn himself. Among everybody who did not vote for Labour, 43% said that was the reason. And among Labour defectors to the Conservatives, 45% said that was the reason. Among those who didn't vote for Labour, 17% said it was Brexit, 12% said it was the economic policies, and among Labour defectors to the Conservatives, 31% said it was the stance on Brexit, and only 6% said it was the economic policies. So I think the general conclusion is that there was distinct unpopularity of Jeremy Corbyn himself, and you and I have talked about this previously, there was a divide between how hardcore party members that had selected him tend to see him and how he is seen in the general public, and then also a component of the Brexit policy. Interestingly, it does not seem that some of the economic policies, many of which had been quite popular in the 2017 election, seems to have not been the main contributing reason for Labour having done so badly. It's also worth noting that Theresa May had made some inroads into these Labour areas in 2017, but made lots of mistakes during the campaign. And so Boris Johnson really finished the job by focusing intensely on Northern England and stressing plans to finalize Brexit, especially in some of these areas that were more rural, had been hit harder by economic globalization, and were more supportive of Brexit.
All right. So how should we understand Boris Johnson? He has this quality of being dismissed as a buffoon, which of course he cultivates with a kind of oddly clownish personality. But he is, notwithstanding certain superficial physical similarities, he is not like Donald Trump in being emotive or, you know, lacking a kind of strategy. So should we understand this as a kind of stroke of brilliance on Boris Johnson's part? Is it luck in his sort of choice of political opponents? Is it demagoguery? What is the explanation for the rise of Boris Johnson in this moment where things were supposed to be ungovernable, his friction within his own party that led to the loss of his majority, and then, you know, pulling this very strong victory out of a hat?
So certainly part of this has to do with weakness on the opposition side. We've just talked about some of the flaws that the Labour Party faced. If you look at the first-past-the-post system within the UK, that contributed to the Liberal Democrats not doing as well. And if you look at the overall numbers, Conservatives who support Brexit won 45% of the vote. Those who back a second referendum and remaining in the EU won 52% of the vote. So there's certainly was an element of an unpopular opposition leader. The vagaries of a first-past-the-post system, which tend to work well in an American model with two main parties, not as well in a system where you have multiple competing parties and fragmentation of the opposition. So leaving some of those personality and structural issues aside and turning to Boris Johnson, there certainly is an argument that he played the politics of this well. He was able to achieve something that Theresa May did not, which is renegotiating the Brexit divorce deal, and in particular, removing the very unpopular backstop for Northern Ireland and replacing it with the Irish Protocol. He was able to effectively target disenfranchised voters in Northern England who were supportive of Brexit and who particularly did not like Jeremy Corbyn himself. And he has also essentially been able to hive off the far right in the form of Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party that has been creating lots of problems for the Conservatives over the last number of years. Nigel Farage's Brexit Party got 2% of the vote, but it failed to win a single seat. It did not contest any of the Conservative seats, and there's estimates that Labour could have lost an additional 20 seats to Farage if he had stood down completely. And so Johnson really is in a place now where he is empowered for the next 5 years. According to the Fixed-Term Parliament Act, you don't need elections for another 5 years. He has a sizable governing majority that is going to enable him to get legislation through. So the real question now is, what does Boris Johnson actually want? He is not dependent on coalition partners, formally or informally. Cameron was on the Liberal Democrats. Theresa May was on Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party. He is not beholden to Nigel Farage and hardliners within his own party on questions of the future relationship with the EU. And so the real question now is, how is Boris Johnson going to govern? What is he going to do on domestic economic policy issues? And what is he going to do in terms of negotiating this future relationship with the EU?
And what do you think the answer to that question is? I mean, Boris Johnson is one of those figures that, you know, whether he is fundamentally opportunistic or fundamentally believes in something is, you know, something that people argue about. But now, presumably, he actually has an opportunity to do what he really wants to do. What do you think a five-year term of Conservative government under Boris Johnson realistically looks like?
That's absolutely the question right now. You had raised the comparison with Donald Trump, and I think those comparisons only go so far. Johnson certainly has seen the populist wave, the sentiment of people that are unhappy with the institutional system. He's been able to make these inroads into these traditional labor areas. He is very aware that these are not necessarily natural labor supporters. He acknowledged that in his victory speech. And so in terms of looking at where he goes on the policies, he, unlike Donald Trump, is a product of the system. He went to Eton. He went to Oxford. He tends to be a social liberal, a bit more fiscally conservative, really falls in line with some of these traditional conservative party values that some of his predecessors have, even if it is sometimes couched in a much more populist and opportunist approach to policy. On the economic side, we did see the Conservative Party in their manifesto giving up the party's recent adherence to austerity policies. A lot of his argument during the campaign was we need to get Brexit done so we can focus on these bread and butter issues that are important to voters. And so there's going to be an effort to increase spending on the National Health Service, to increase spending on things like security. There's been a number of knife crimes, for example, in London in recent months that are causing concern. Spending on things like police, on teachers, teachers, on education. So I think we will see a more robust economic policy that is focused on some of these spending mechanisms than what we necessarily have seen in the recent history from a conservative government. On the Brexit side, there's going to be tension there because you have had the hardliners in the party advocating a much more rigorous departure from the EU on things like level playing field commitments, for example. And that's something that Boris Johnson seems to support. The Labour and other parties who have wanted a softer Brexit have argued for much more alignment. One of the things that was quite interesting and I think gives you a sense of where Boris is likely to go on that is that he is looking to amend the withdrawal bill legislation to make it illegal for his government to agree an extension to the negotiating period for formalizing these trade arrangements with the EU. So he's essentially trying to legislatively tie his own hands to prevent him from doing something that he doesn't want to do anyway. So I think there's a strong message from him that he is going to move forward quickly with getting the UK out of the EU. I think he is likely to face conflict with the EU in terms of trying to reach agreement on what that future relationship looks like. And I think we are likely to see more spending and investment on domestic economic policies, at least in the near term.
All right. So you've sort of done this in this last answer, but let's do it explicitly now. Let's turn this from British electoral politics, which in principle is kind of beyond the scope of Lawfare's interests, to the kind of Brexit and security issues that, you know, cause us to be interested in this subject to begin with. So we have a January 31st next deadline. I take it the immediate practical consequence of this electoral vote is that that deadline for the withdrawal agreement will be met and Britain is now functionally out of the EU. Is there any reason to think that that's not correct?
No, I think that is correct. So on Thursday, December 19th, the Queen is going to open Parliament. She is going to give a speech setting out the government's agenda. Members will then go home for the holiday period. And when they come back in January, order number one is going to be passing the withdrawal agreement bill that implements Brexit on the UK side. Boris Johnson had already gotten provisional support for that from the old parliament before elections. And so now that he has the sizable majority, it is likely that that will go through very quickly. The European Parliament then needs to ratify the divorce deal on its side, which is largely expected to be a formality. And so it seems almost certain that the UK will be able to leave the EU before the January 31st deadline.
No chance of a second referendum at this point.
Absolutely not. And Boris Johnson was extremely clear on that in his election speech or his victory speech, where he said, quote, "This election means that getting Brexit done is the irrefutable, irresistible, unarguable decision of the British people. And this puts an end to all of those little miserable threats of a second referendum."
These little miserable threats. I like that line. Not because I agree with it, just because I think it's poetic. All right.
But the one thing to flag on that is Boris Johnson has been talking about getting Brexit done. And just because that part is going to be done by January 31st, that really is only the end of the beginning. The UK and the EU then need to negotiate their future relationship. And that's going to entail coming to agreement on what sort of economic relationship they are going to have in the future. Will it be a free trade agreement? How much alignment will there be on regulations? The current deadline to complete that process is December 31, 2020. And this is what Boris Johnson has said he is not prepared to extend. If he did want to request an extension, he would need to make that request next June. Most experts believe
right.
It's going to be impossible for the two sides to reach agreement on this relationship. They point to the recently agreed EU-Canada free trade agreement, which took 6 years to negotiate. And so if that agreement is not reached by then, it is possible that the UK would still crash out of the EU, at least on the economic side, without economic arrangements in place and return to WTO trading rules.
Right. But this would be a sort of more limited crash out in the sense that presumably they may reach agreement on certain things and not on others. So you could imagine lots of situations in which there would be, you know, a kind of reversion to WTO rules on issues that were not resolved, and they could resolve the issues they could resolve. Is that right?
Right. So the EU had insisted on sequencing this in two parts. One, they wanted to finalize the divorce, and that part is going to be done by the end of January. They then wanted to hold out negotiations on the future relationship as a second part. So you can really think of the UK by the end of January as having the divorce deal done, but then needing to decide on the future. And all of next year during this transition period, the UK will remain a functioning member of the EU in the sense that all of the current travel rules, the study rules, all of those things will remain into place, but the UK will no longer have voting rights within the European Union. So the divorce part of this will be done. What is left is hashing out what cooperation is going to look like, primarily on economic issues, but also on a number of other fronts, such as security cooperation, data protection, aviation, energy, any sort of area is where the UK as a third country would want to cooperate with the EU in the future.
Right. And so let's tick through those, because those are kind of core Lawfare podcast kind of issues, at least security and data protection. But let's start with Ireland, because, you know, the big hang-up issue is, or has been, the Northern Irish border issue. And so where does a ratification of or an implementation of the exit agreement as currently negotiated by the UK and the EU on January 31st, where does it leave Ireland?
So under the previous withdrawal agreement negotiated by Theresa May, all of the discussions about Northern Ireland were as a backstop provision in case this future arrangement was not put in place. Boris Johnson got rid of the backstop and replaced it with this new Irish protocol, which is permanent in the relationship going forward. And so once the UK and the EU have an agreement on their future relationship, the idea is that the entire UK would leave the EU customs union, but Northern Ireland would stay aligned with EU customs rules and with VAT rules within the European Union. So it essentially prevents the need for customs checks on goods going north-south and creates a bit of a border in the Irish Sea to check goods that are going east and west. The fundamental decision that the UK needs to make in terms of its future trading relationship with the EU, which will then guide what it can do with the US and others, is how much it wants to stay aligned with the EU. The EU is going into these negotiations with a very clear emphasis on wanting to maintain level playing field provisions and a significant amount of regulatory alignment. Many hardliners within the UK want to have scope for much greater deviation. While we're on Ireland, the other thing to note that was interesting coming out of the election was the results in Northern Ireland, where the Democratic Unionist Party suffered a number of losses, including its parliamentary leader seat, to hardline nationalist Sinn Féin. We also now have more nationalist MPs elected from Northern Ireland, 9, as opposed to 8 unionist. And so it shows a bit of a political shift in Northern Ireland. We also saw support for the DUP and Sinn Féin drop significantly from 2017, while there was growing support for the Cross-Community Alliance Party. So some interesting realignment in Northern Ireland politics as well.
And how do you read that? It's not really what I would expect. You know, if you'd asked me before the election, given what Boris Johnson did in dropping the backstop and creating the sort of quasi-customs border at the Irish Sea, I would have expected Democratic Unionists strengthening as Unionist sentiment in Northern Ireland sort of rallies behind the idea that, you know, that's not where the border is. To the extent there's a border, it should be a border at the line of the six counties. I would not have expected lots of support to Sinn Féin. And so clearly I would have been wrong. How do you understand the explanation for this apparent shift?
I think there had been growing frustration with the DUP in terms of its hardline stance on some of these issues. There was significant support in Northern Ireland for the backstop, recognizing how damaging a border on the island itself was going to be. And the DUP still ended up objecting to the proposals that Boris Johnson ended up putting forward with this new Irish protocol. I think there also was growing concern about Brexit, with people seeing the real challenges and consequences that it was going to create in Northern Ireland. And we've also seen some shift in identity politics, that just because people didn't like the Brexit deal doesn't necessarily mean that they support unification of the island of Ireland. And so I think that's part of the reason that we saw a resurgence of support for the Cross Community Alliance Party. And then there was also some growing support for the softer nationalist SDLP, the Social Democratic and Labour Party, which took a seat from the DUP and one from Sinn Féin. And so there was a little bit of softening on both of the sides there. And there is nervousness still, I think, in Northern Ireland about how this protocol is going to operate, since rather than simply being an insurance policy, it is going to be the rule of the road going forward. And if the UK decides to deviate significantly from the European Union, this is going to eventually cause deviation between Ireland or Northern Ireland and the rest of Great Britain.
All right. So let's talk about the security and data protection issues. I assume that the current state of the understandings on those issues between the EU and the UK is pretty near zero. Is that right?
The question that the UK is going to answer is whether or not it wants to continue to stay aligned to these EU rules. There had been some question in the UK about how much security cooperation it wanted to do within the EU generally, preferring to do more of that in NATO. There's going to be questions about how the UK aligns on things like data protection with the rest of the EU. Certainly, there are going to be many in the US who are going to be looking to see if there is decisions to deviate on the UK side, which could end up increasing the potential for cooperation on the American side. And so all of these are issues on which the UK will have to decide whether to stay aligned or not. If they stay aligned, it makes it much easier for them to engage with their largest neighbor. If they deviate, it opens up space for greater cooperation with the United States and others in some of these areas.
And how is all of this playing in Europe? So, you know, Europe has kind of, on the one hand, Europe has a kind of allergy to the idea of a member state leaving. On the other hand, the British have been such a pain in the ass over the last few years that there's a fair bit of good riddance, let's just get them out and move on sentiment. But now that this is kind of final, you know, how is it playing in Brussels?
There certainly has been a sense of sadness over the last 3 years about the British decision to leave the European Union. It was not something that the EU wanted, but they were prepared to respect the decision of the British voters. But certainly, as you say, especially over the last year, there's been a huge amount of fatigue within Brussels about the amount of political bandwidth and time this was taking, as all of the Commission directorates were having to spend time preparing for Brexit, preparing for contingency planning if there was a hard Brexit. And so I think there is a sense of relief that there is at least clarity now on what is happening in the British political system, and there is the ability to shift the focus toward going forward. That said, I think there had been a lot of healthy skepticism about Boris Johnson's election campaign pledge to get Brexit done, given that there was the recognition that in many ways the much tougher fights now had to happen. So in terms of negotiating the divorce, it was fairly clear what the provisions were that needed to be agreed. And with the exception of the handling of the Irish border, a lot of those were relatively clear. But now we are moving on to the much more difficult and the much more contentious fights. And what you are already seeing is the EU arguing that it wants to maintain level playing field commitments, that it wants the UK to agree to continue aligning on a certain number of regulations to end up easing trade between the two sides. sides. And yet at the same time, you have Boris Johnson taking a much tougher stance, suggesting that that's not going to be the case. And so even though there is some clarity, there is some relief, we are going to be able to finalize the divorce within the next couple of weeks, I think there is an expectation that 2020 is going to be quite contentious between the two sides while they try and hammer out arrangements on what this actually looks like.
One of the issues on which Johnson was most effective in this campaign, but also just sort of more generally over the last few years, is the number of Eastern Europeans living in the UK and what the Europeans call the free movement of goods and people, and to a lot of UK nationals is, from their point of view, uncontrolled immigration. Is there a clear path forward as you negotiate this aspect of it? Or is this an issue in which the fundamental premise of the Brexiteers, which is to slap a whole bunch of controls on this, and this is one of the key reasons that Brexit has been popular in the UK, is this anti-immigration stance simply irreconcilable with what the EU will go into these negotiations wanting and expecting?
So most of that was hashed out in this process of finalizing the divorce. One of the provisions in the withdrawal agreement has to do with the rights of citizens and specifically looks at those EU nationals that were living in the UK and British nationals that were living in the European Union. And so arrangements have been put in place for those citizens that are resident in the respective countries for a certain period of time. For example, you have a number of Brits who have perhaps retired on the southern coast of Spain and really want to stay living there and ensure that they can receive their pensions. You also have French, Germans, Eastern Europeans, others that have been living in the UK for a number of years. And so the UK has had an online system, an app, where people can apply for settled residency status. And so that issue has largely been resolved for people that meet the criteria and have been living in one place or the other for a certain number of years. It seems very unlikely in this new plan that there is going to be unfettered access for EU members to be able to move to the UK. The UK will no longer be a member state. It will no longer be applying these provisions of free movement of people. You know, the other part that the UK wanted was to get their own passports back and not be able to travel throughout the EU on EU passports as they had before. And so I think the primary negotiations are going to be focusing on the movements of goods and economic standards.
I see. I was actually talking about not about the people who are already either UK residents living in the EU or EU residents living in the UK, but future people who might want to. And you think that that is, I would expect that that would have to be negotiated at some level, or would that be just domestic immigration law in the UK would define that and it wouldn't be a subject of future negotiation?
That certainly is my understanding, that with the exception of those who are already settled there now, the UK will no longer be a member of the EU, and so countries will not necessarily have a privileged right for their nationals to move there. I mean, I don't see how in the future it would necessarily be any easier for a German to move to the UK than it would be for me to move to the UK.
I see. So finally, let's talk about whether the UK itself is going to break up. You've had a long-term pattern of devolution of authority from Parliament to Scotland and Northern Ireland. The Scottish government is run by a secessionist party. What does Boris Johnson's election mean for the various components of the UK that have ambiguous relations with the idea of being part of it?
There certainly are going to be a lot of questions coming out of this election about the long-term unity of the United Kingdom. We've already touched a little bit on Northern Ireland, where there's been some shifting politics. I think Sinn Féin are going to continue to call for a border poll on unification, which doesn't seem imminent, but is something that is likely to rumble along in the background. The most immediate clash is going to be between London and Edinburgh. The Scottish National Party won a resounding victory in Scotland. They won 48 of the 59 seats. They got 45% of the vote. Which was an 8% increase from the 2017 elections. And so the Scottish National Party is certainly going to have a very dominant voice in Westminster. Nicola Sturgeon, who's the leader of the Scottish government in Scotland, has already been arguing that this sends a very clear signal that Scotland does not want a Boris Johnson Conservative government, they don't want to leave the European Union, and they want Scotland's future to be in Scotland's hands. Sturgeon has already said that she is going to be sending to Boris Johnson before Christmas a request that the Scottish Parliament be given the legal powers to hold a second independence referendum. You might recall that they held a referendum in 2014 that failed. Sturgeon and others would argue that Brexit qualitatively changes the nature of the question, and therefore people should have the ability to vote again. Johnson has indicated his opposition to another referendum. He's not only opposed to a second Brexit referendum, is also opposed to a second Scottish referendum, and he has described the 2014 polls as a once-in-a-lifetime vote. So this is going to continue to be a clash. There's elections scheduled for the Scottish Parliament in 2021, and so certainly if the SNP is returned with a sizable majority there, this call is only going to increase. So I think for now, Boris Johnson is going to continue to push back on calls for a second referendum. He is going to have his hands full finalizing the divorce with the European Union, but I think as Brexit continues to unfold, and as the SNP remains a significant political force in Scotland, this is a clash between London and Edinburgh that is going to continue for the next several years.
We will follow it with you as it does. Amanda Sloat, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Amanda Sloat for coming on the show. If you have a second, please share this Lawfare podcast on social media. Talk us up at your holiday gatherings, and of course, give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.